Senate Labor and Commerce to order. It's March 22nd and 1:40. With us today, Senator Seekins, Senator Stevens, and myself, Bundy. Senator Ellis is excused. And first on our schedule today is Senate Bill 140, banning Internet spyware. And Mr. Stancliff, is here. Senator Terrio is in a position where he'd like to clone himself.
There is a quorum call next door that he is honoring.
Oh, well, Senator Terrio, I'm sure we can be educated by your staff if you'd like, but welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for scheduling up Senate Bill 140.
Senator, we now have the directional mics.
I've introduced Senate Bill 140 to accomplish two main objectives. The first is to send a message to computer invaders that it will be illegal in Alaska to conduct certain practices involving the injection of unwanted malicious programs into computers. The second objective is to heighten through the legislative process both the awareness of the magnitude of the spyware problem and how to deal with it in the most cost-effective and time-efficient manner. Neither myself nor my staff are experts or presumed to be experts in this field, so we have, through research, made contact with a nationally recognized expert who has worked with us in drafting Senate Bill 140 and will be an extremely valuable resource for you, members of the committee, and other legislators as the process moves forward. This gentleman's name is Ben Edelman. He is online and will make a short presentation to the committee today. Mr. Edelman holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Economics from Harvard College and a Master's degree in Statistics from the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. In addition, Mr. Curtis Clothier from our own data processing section will present a short summary of the problem and the costs associated with the invasion of computer programs. Virtually every branch of state, local, and local governments has the type of problems Mr. Clothier will reveal. Every school, the university, and every business are heavily impacted by the cost of dealing with unwanted injected computer programs. The cost of dealing with these invaders nationally to private citizens alone are in excess of $21 billion. That figure is based on an average of 3 to 6 minutes each day people use to clean or otherwise deal with unwanted programs that affect their computers, whether they be at work or at home. The challenge in this legislation will be to keep it targeted at unscrupulous and malicious sources while not being so broad as to damage legitimate uses of computer programs. Some of the more technical nuances in this regard undoubtedly will be taken up in the Judiciary Committee when the bill moves from this committee to this next committee or referral. Senate Bill 140 is broadly based on the Utah model with some features of the California version that have been worked into the text. While it may be very difficult to locate and prosecute those who ply their invasive practices here in Alaska, the sheer magnitude of the problem moves me and hopefully our legislative body to declare such activities to be illegal in the state. With this action, a basis for legal recourse becomes available to those who wish to pursue these violators, and I ask for your support and support of the other committee members in moving the bill forward. With that, I am available for questions, but as I've indicated, we do have other people signed up that have more of a technical background in this issue.
For the record, Senator Davis has joined us, and I think we'll be interested in joining you in violating the violators. We're at your disposal. How would you like to proceed as far as expert testimony?
I think next we have Mr. Clothier from our own data processing, and then Mr. Edelman will have a short presentation after that.
Okay, and will that, the first one involve?
Yes, he's got a PowerPoint.
Okay.
To walk the committee through.
All right, thank you, Mr. Clothier. And you're welcome to join us, or you have other duties?
Yeah, next door, but I'll be back.
Good afternoon. For the record, please.
For the record, my name is Curtis Clothier. I'm the Data Processing Manager for the Legislative Affairs Agency, and I've been asked to give a short presentation, a primer, if you will, on spyware, what it is, how it affects us here in the legislature, as well as answer any questions you might have.
Okay, if I could just ask to have that mic pointed at your chin, that will be helpful.
All right. Thank you. Spyware is a growing problem, not only for us, but as Senator Terrio said, for everybody in the country, as well as Alaska. Spyware is a very broad term and has a lot of different implications, but for the purposes of my presentation, I'd like to give you a definition that simply states that spyware is software that collects personal information or makes changes on your computer without your knowledge or consent. This information that's collected can be something as simple as the websites you visit or something as sensitive as your passwords, credit card information, account numbers, and such. Spyware is also oftentimes accompanied by something called adware. An adware is typically something that launches customized advertisements on your computer and lots of them. Spyware is a relatively new technology. The first real documented case of spyware is in early 2000. In 2003, it really started to hit the radar screens as far as technology was concerned. In 2003, there was a study conducted by IDC that estimated that 2 out of 100 support calls to support help desks were related to spyware. These days, it's estimated to be 2 out of 5 calls for technical support are related to spyware. Further, Dell and Microsoft have huge percentages of support calls related to spyware. Dell admits 20% of their calls are related to these pests, and Microsoft claims 50%. When spyware does get on your computer, it has a lot of different appearances. Of course, we talked about pop-ups. Your home page can be changed, and other settings on your computer changed. New toolbars will appear. Icons will show up. From a support standpoint, we get the call at our help desk when the computer starts slowing down and crashing, and we see this quite often.
And the virus guards are not helpful in this regard?
Senator, no. The virus guards typically check just for viruses. Spyware usually makes its way through the web browser, and most of our virus guards are aimed at email or viruses that are already on your computer and files.
Thank you.
This was just a quick screenshot of a computer that has lots of pop-ups, and if I happened to have this computer, I would definitely be using a spy sweeper to clean it up. Back to how spyware does get on your computer. It's generally by having a user download or install some application that's free. When I say free, there's free screensavers out on the internet. There's free toolbars, there's software applications to download and share music, check weather, check stocks, what have you. Ordinarily, when you you click on such a thing, when you're web browsing, you come up with some sort of an installation message like the one we have here on the screen, and our studies show that most people just go ahead and click yes on this stuff right away. Further, during the installation process, you'll get what's called a end-user licensing agreement. This one's from a company called Gator, who is a pretty well-known spyware author. And if you take a look at the end-user license agreement, which is this item here, you'll see it's a pretty long agreement. I think it's about 80 clicks of your mouse to read through all of it. And most people don't have the patience or the time to read through all this, so they click, I've read the agreement, and they go on, and the spyware is loaded and installed on their computer. Many of the spyware applications don't even have an end-user license agreement, so you don't know what you're agreeing to, or you don't really know what's happening when the software is put on your computer. So as I mentioned, spyware, it comes into your computer. It will change your settings. It will make modifications to do whatever the author wants it to do. These changes are rarely documented, and usually you don't have any idea what's happening. when Windows or any other software operating system is built, it's built to Microsoft standards. They test it and they release it. As spyware is added onto your computer, it starts changing things, and no one really knows what's being changed. And the cumulative effect of all these little changes adds to the problem of your computer slowing down or it crashing. Now, one point I'd like to make here is there is a type of software that collects information which isn't necessarily bad. For instance, when you buy a computer, I can think of a couple of examples, Gateway, Sony. They have software on the computer preloaded that sort of gives you or gives them an indication of your computer's health. And generally, when you get a new computer and you do the installation process, it tells you that's what's happening. Likewise, there's software in the marketplace that has a free version and a paid version. These sorts of softwares, again, tell you what you're getting. You can pay for the software and it works, or you can pay for another version which is free, but you get advertising bundled into it. These are pretty straightforward, and most of us don't have a problem with it. It's the knowledge and consent thing, which is, I think, is really critical on unloading software. Once you do have spyware on your computer, it usually requires a call from a technical support person or someone that's reasonably savvy. It requires running several different programs to rid the spyware from your computer, and it's not always successful. Here in the legislature, we've got two or three tools we use. Sometimes we'll use as many as five different tools to try and fix a computer, and there's occasions when the stuff just won't come out, and it's better just to burn down the computer and start over and put a new load of the operating system on and reinstall everything. And getting back to how we do business here at the legislature, we have quite a few defenses. One thing that everyone recommends is keeping your software current, and we do that. We have numerous antivirus systems. We've got spam filters. We have content filters. We've got firewalls. We have software removal tools, and we have a staff that, we do a lot of training. We have workshops on this stuff. Yet despite all our best efforts, we do get between four and five, on average, machines a week that are infected with spyware. Each of these calls can take as many as several hours to fix. Sometimes it's a few-minute fix. Sometimes it's an all-day fix. If the computer is located in Bethel or Barrow or Kotzebue, it's really a matter of them boxing up the computer and being without a system for several days while it's repaired and sent back. One bullet I noted here on the bottom is spyware prevention and removal now takes more of our time than virus and spam issues. It's really risen to that level of support issue. As far as solutions to the problem, there really isn't any one good solution. We're trying to focus on educating our customers, basically the users in the legislature, that this is an issue, urge them to surf safely, surf to well-known sites, don't click on advertisements to download software and such. There are technological solutions in the offing that we're testing. We have some other products that are spyware removal programs that we're going to be rolling out here in the next few months, and that'll be a moving battle, moving target as time goes on. We come up with a solution, of course, and the bad guys come up with a new way to get around them. And finally, and why we're here today is the third piece of the puzzle is anti-spyware legislation that would give a recourse to users who may have been harmed through spyware loss of their computer operations for a period of time. The future, there doesn't seem to be any indication that spyware is going to be on the decline. Everything points to more of it. Spyware leads to identity theft. And we're reading more and more incidents involving organized crime breaking into computers and pushing this stuff out. The reason organized crime and everybody else is involved in it is because it involves money. Whether the money is legitimate in that it's involved in advertising or marketing, or whether it's illegal and actual theft of personal information. All these indicators lead us to believe it's going to be an ongoing problem for the foreseeable future. In fact, this last slide I have here, just to sort of summarize, is I did a Google search on spyware legislation yesterday, and this is three fresh articles yesterday, Utah, Maryland, and the U.S. Senate, and they're all working on spyware legislation as we speak. So we're not alone in this battle. It's a battle that's going to be going on for a while. I know I went through that awful fast, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. The question that comes to mind is, I think Senator Terrio covered it earlier. Obviously, we'd like the protection. I think we, all computer users, we pass a law that's illegal in Alaska, and then enforcement comes to mind. And are there programs that could basically do like a phone trap and find the origin of the spyware?
Senator, there are programs that can trace things, but in the vast majority of cases, the people who are doing it are covering their tracks very well. And even if you could locate them many times, they've moved on from that physical location, so it's really difficult to follow the path of where it came from in most cases. The legitimate vendors, when I say legitimate, the people who are doing advertising, it's more of an easier case to go ahead and find them. But if it's something that's strictly illegal or if it's overseas, it's really tough.
And so if we were to pass this into law, we would get those people who are, as you call, legitimate vendors to stop their activity, but there would still be the problem with the serious criminals.
Yeah, Senator, yes, the end user license agreements we saw up there, they're made complex on purpose. I'm sure that the vendors could do a better job of making it clear what they're intending to do with this free software they're giving you. Certainly, it's such a mess right now that no one reads it, and people who aren't really savvy to the technology just say yes to everything and trap themselves.
So we need to protect people from themselves a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Sort of like a seatbelt or something. Okay. Other questions for Mr. Slovier? Seeing at this time, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us and getting us up to speed on the problem. Senator Terrio, with your permission, then we'd go to Mr. Edelman to continue our discussion of the problem. Mr. Edelman, are you with us?
I am. Thank you. I apologize, Senators, for being unable to attend in person. It's an awfully long trip, but I owe you a bit of introduction to start with. My name is Benjamin Edelman. I am an independent researcher studying and testing spyware in my lab. In my spare time, I guess, I'm also a PhD student at Harvard University, working on a dissertation in the economics department about a number of topics that are at least loosely related to spyware, some internet fraud topics more generally. I especially appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today to say a little bit about the spyware problem as I see it, about the status of legislation here and elsewhere, the bill itself that's before you, and some comments on the logistics of enforcement, the constitutional problems that some folks have been worried about, and other matters probably of concern. As the committee is aware, spyware has become quite a serious problem. There's a lot of software on a typical PC. It isn't there because the PC's user, owner, or operator wants it there, but rather because some spyware company found a way to sneak it on and to make money once it's there. The kinds of pop-ups that Mr. Clothier showed you in the prior presentation are certainly one of their ways of sneaking on, though there are others that can entail more or, in general, less consent, not even any on-screen representation like what he showed you. Some of these programs do bona fide spying. They track your name, your emails, your credit card purchases, and so forth. Others have a purpose that might seem less nefarious, but that has proven actually to be quite a bit more profitable, tracking what you do, what websites you go to, and then showing you extra pop-up ads, generally for the competitors of the sites you ask for. So to be very specific about this, if you go to Hertz.com, the Hertz car rental site, they might give you an ad for Budget. In fact, they might cover up the entire Hertz site with a Budget ad. Why will they do that? Well, the kind of person who wants to rent a car from Hertz might well be someone who's willing to rent the car from Budget instead, especially if they don't even really realize what has just happened. They might see that they're at a car rental site and go forward with the transaction. So that's a great way for Budget to get a new customer. and it's so great that Budget is willing to pay serious money for it. Should we call this advertising? Should we say that it's legitimate? I'm not sure I'd use the word legitimate quite so many times as Mr. Clothier did. The fact is, there's nothing at all legitimate about putting yourself out as Hertz when, in fact, you're Budget. But that's the kind of thing that these companies are doing, sometimes with better labeling, sometimes with worse labeling, and with users caught very much in the crossfire. The poor user just wants to rent a car, and now instead of having one car rental site on screen, they have two or three or four that are sort of battling for the user's attention and purchases. So it's my sense that these kinds of programs are a big part of the spyware problem, and they're a problem that new legislation really can help with. The folks who are stealing credit card numbers or tracking your Social Security number, they're outside of the United States, they're hard to find, and they're already flagrantly violating lots of laws. So there's no clear benefit to passing another law that they'd be breaking. What we need to deal with them is some real hard enforcement, and that's a topic for another day. On the other hand, these pop-up ad companies operate in what some folks have considered a gray zone. Some people think that it is legitimate to show a big ad for Budget that covers all of Hertz when Hertz is what you asked for. I think it's pretty clear that that's a bad business to be in. It's not only deeply unethical and confusing to consumers, trading on consumers' ability to be tricked, but also it creates these troubling economic incentives where everyone and his brother wants to sneak on your computer so that they can show you this kind of pop-up ad, and the result of so many people wanting to be on your computer is, of course, the very rise in the spyware problem that we heard about from Mr. Clothier. So the bill before you focuses on these pop-up ads. It says that it's not a legitimate business practice to show a user an ad for one company when the user asked for that company's competitor or for some other site by domain name. So if I picked up my cell phone and I called 1-800-American trying to reach American Airlines, that wouldn't be legitimate for Sprint to connect me to United instead, even if United offered a nice advertising fee to my cell phone company. That's not fair competition. Neither can a Walmart employee come into the local Target and tap customers on the shoulder as they're waiting in line to check out. That's not fair competition. Somehow we have the idea, though, that when this advertising is done on a computer screen, what would be unfair in the real world becomes completely acceptable. You ask for Hertz, you get Budget. It seems wrong to me. Some courts have gone one way, some courts have gone the other way, and this bill makes it very clear that the judgment of the legislature, the state of Alaska, is no, not here, not us. I want to say a little bit about the approaches that other legislatures have taken in thinking about these issues. California passed a bill last year that takes, undeniably, quite a different approach from what's before you today. They name about a dozen specific tactics that they rightly point out are absolutely abominable, like using one person's computer as part of an attack against another computer. And then, of course, California prohibits such tactics. It's an interesting strategy. Certainly, they've named a lot of behaviors that really are problematic, but I think it's ultimately ineffective. The tactics they use are tactics that are so outrageous that they're not being used by the biggest companies trying to sneak onto users' computers. Anyone with an installed base of millions and with a Manhattan Avenue address and lawyers and lobbyists, you know, they know better than to use one computer to attack another to try to damage or disable the other. That's just not the kind of business they're in. And there are lobbyists out there who are going to tell you that California's bill is good law, and I guess they've gotten copies of it introduced in 13 different state legislatures in just the first 3 months of this year. So clearly some folks like it. But read the bill for yourself, maybe even read what I wrote about it on my site, an article dated November 29th. I think you'll see that the specific practices that that bill bans are so narrow as to be really ineffective in making a difference. And sure enough, in the past 4 months that bill has been in effect, you know, nothing has happened in terms of making the spyware problem better. In D.C., there are also legislators talking about spyware, and state legislatures naturally always have to be worried about being preempted by federal law. There are a couple bills still in the pipeline in D.C. It's not entirely clear which one is thought to be best or at greatest likelihood of being passed. Representative Bono of California introduced a bill that bans a number of specific but narrow practices, much like the problem in the California bill I described. She also requires certain notice and consent upon installation. But I worry that, exactly as Mr. Clothier said, you can't get through the problem of installation with just a couple of sentences in a bill. Users get tricked so easily into pressing yes on almost anything you show them that it's a tall order to write a piece of legislation that actually thinks through the kind of consent that users would need to be shown in order to meaningfully approve of the installation of software onto their computers. That isn't to say it's not a worthy task that we should adopt one day, but it certainly isn't something that Representative Bono has done successfully in her bill, and it's not one that I would take on lightly. So it's great that your bill before you today doesn't require that you successfully define consent. You managed to make some headway against the spyware problem without going through exactly what must be shown on screen for a program to be installed. Utah last year passed legislation that has some important similarities to what this committee is considering today. And in fact, just last week, the governor of Utah signed into law a bill on which this bill is modeled. Utah's language last year certainly could have been drafted a bit more tightly. It's important to be clear for constitutional purposes on who is and isn't covered, that the bill covers computers that are in Utah. Perhaps the bill covers companies in Utah, but a computer in New York and a spyware program made by someone in Texas, no, that's not something that the bill could permissibly cover. If no one is in Alaska, then you can't have any Alaska law regulating it. But if either the computer or the spyware company or the harmed business were in Alaska, now we start to have a permissible nexus, it seems to me. It's important to think through all of these constitutional problems, of course. One doesn't want to pass a bill and find it overruled on constitutional grounds. It's just a waste of effort and a real setback in terms of making actual headway against the problem. On the other hand, when a critic comes to you and says, hey, you know, this bill is unconstitutional, that shouldn't be an absolute trump card, where merely uttering those words ends the discussion. One would need to conduct a rigorous analysis to figure out whether it's actually true. I do think there are a couple other complaints that critics are likely to levy at a bill like this one that are worth thinking through. One is the suggestion that this somehow grants extra protections to trademark holders and that would in turn be bad for consumers. Suggestion is that if we say Hertz has the right to have their site displayed intact on screen and budget can't interfere with that, then we're giving a windfall to Hertz. I see where these people are coming from in raising that objection, but it's important to think through exactly who is being harmed and who is being benefited. It seems to me that users are receiving the brunt of the benefit. Users are being spared from an unwanted assault of pop-up ads. When a user types in Hertz.com, it's quite clear the user wants Hertz. The user does not want 10 different pop-up ads for 10 different competitors. If the user wanted to know what the competitors were, the user would have gone to Google and typed in Hertz or typed in car rental. And so it seems to me that this actually is a bill that's good for consumers, of course, that being the committee's aspiration. Last year in Utah, I was really surprised by the number of software companies that objected to the state of Utah passing any bill as to software at all. They seemed to have the idea that if what they were making was software, and it was, then they should be exempt from any government regulation, especially from any state government regulation. That seems entirely wrong to me. People who make products have to comply with laws in all 50 states and federal laws too, and that's just the way it goes if you want to make and sell products in the United States. But you'll see some software companies coming up to Alaska if they get really concerned, saying, no role for any legislation here. We should be left alone, industry self-regulation. And you'll have to ask yourself, how is industry self-regulation going so far? Isn't there some role for someone to try to step in and make things better? Finally, some critics will say that enforcement of the bill is difficult or impossible, and to some extent, I suppose I agree. It's hard to find those bad actors who are offshore, who are outside of the United States. On the other hand, the folks who are doing the biggest harms, who are harming the most consumers with the most pop-up ads and the most unwanted software on their computers, these are big companies. Gator, whose license agreement you were shown previously, they're a company that was talking about going public, that is being traded on the New York Stock Exchange. They have an office in San Francisco. They have investors all over the place, big U.S. companies. Other spyware, adware-type companies have investments from the absolute biggest of venture capital firms. They have Manhattan addresses. They have lawyers and lobbyists. These are folks we can get to. And to the extent that they have big companies advertising with them, Budget Car Rental or Expedia, or you name it, we can get to their advertisers too. It is not impossible to find these folks. They're in the advertising business. They have to show you the ads. We can figure out where the ads are coming from. We can figure out who the ads are promoting. We can hold these people responsible. Finally, as to the question of a phone tap or the difficulty of figuring out who's in Alaska and who's not, I think that's absolutely an important question. The bill actually speaks to that in great detail. I'll pull up the section citation as soon as I stop having to talk and try to use my computer at the same time. But the bill proposes two different ways by which a software company can figure out who's in Alaska and who isn't. The two ways are as follows. One, you can always ask the user, are you an Alaska user? If so, click here. And then it says, I'm sorry, we can't install this software on your computer because you're in the state of Alaska, and this software isn't legal in the state of Alaska, just like so many other things that aren't sold into particular states, a credit card offer that can't be accepted by people in particular states, and so forth. Number two, and more in the vein of the phone trace, yes, when a computer is in Alaska, its IP address indicates its Alaska address. It's pretty easy to figure out that a computer is in one place rather than another. If anyone's ever traveled internationally and typed in google.com while in France, you'll find that you get Google in French just by being in France, even if what you requested was the ordinary google.com address. They know you're in France. Similarly, they can tell that you're in Alaska if you are. And so the bill specifically says, if you're using that kind of detection method, that's good enough. You make a good faith effort to determine who's in Alaska. You use the kinds of technical systems that people use for this purpose, and that's good enough to comply with the bill's obligations. So I think I'll leave it at that. I'd be pleased to be of assistance if there's any way I can help the committee think through these important issues, and I very much appreciate the ability to speak to you all today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing your expertise with us. I see no questions at this time. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who would like to testify on Senate Bill 140? Senator Terrio, would you like to rejoin us? It's committee practice that we don't pass a bill the first time we hear it and give us a chance to delve a little more deeply into the subject. Have you had opposition or concerns from companies in Alaska about your bill?
Not that I'm aware of, no. My staff is just indicating to me that, no, we've not been contacted with any expressions of opposition.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add to?
No, Mr. Chairman. I think the presenters that we've had today have done a good job. And one of the things I was just asking staff here that, you know, there's all these different little terms. It's hard to keep up as they create new things, but such a thing as a cookie, we might want to ask just for a little bit of information, differentiation of a cookie from spyware, you know, in case you are or hear some concerns that, you know, legitimate uses would be preempted.
Isn't a cookie really a form of spyware?
Oh, and I guess perhaps
Mr. Edelman, are you still with us?
I've been unmuted. Perfect.
Okay.
In my judgment, a cookie is not a form of spyware. This is a point of some controversy, and let me tell you the basis. I hope you'll conclude it to be a principled basis by which I reached that conclusion. A cookie is a data file that a website can place on a user's computer in order to store for that website's future access any information that the user has told that website. So let's be very specific about it. If you go to NewYorkTimes.com, you sign up to create an account so you can read all the news, and then you say, save my password. How are they going to save your password? They're going to save it in a cookie, so the next time you go back to the New York Times website, they still know that you're you. That's awfully convenient. We don't want to ban that. That's not hurting anyone. That's actually helping quite a bit. And there are any number of other occasions in which it's helpful that these cookies exist. At Amazon, the way they keep track of what books would be helpful to you, what recommendations you'd most appreciate, again, it's all based on cookies. Cookies do not slow down your computer. Cookies do not show extra pop-up ads. Cookies don't make your computer crash. Cookies don't send your passwords to anyone other than the websites that they belong to. They don't send your social security number anywhere. they don't install other programs on your PC. They're awfully safe, to my eye, in that they just don't cause any of the problems that spyware causes. Cookies are mere data. It's like having an extra file on your computer. It is having an extra file on your computer, which may sound worrisome, but so long as the file is of a particular innocuous format, it's really no problem whatsoever. In contrast, bona fide spyware, well, it can do all those things that I just said cookies can't do. It can track your activity at many websites, not just one. It can figure out what passwords you're using for many websites, not just the one you're going to. It can show you extra pop-up ads. It can install more programs. It certainly can make your computer slower and can make your computer crash. So it seems to me that there's no need to talk about cookies in a spyware bill. And sure enough, definitions 6B5 says in very specific language, cookies are not spyware. I think that's the right result. That's the same thing that Congress said in Representative Bono's bill, H.R. 29. It was amended just last month to be even more specific on this issue, lest anyone have any doubt. And I don't think there was much doubt under the earlier draft of the bill, but under the latest draft of the bill, they've said three different ways, cookies are not spyware, cookies are not spyware, cookies are not spyware. So I think the bill is in good shape on that issue.
Thank you. Senator Davis has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ellerman, you sort of critiqued several states' laws that they have put in place. You've had time to read this one. What do you think about this particular bill?
Yes, Senator, I think this is a strong bill, and let me be specific about why I think that. One, it addresses bad actors who can be identified and can be held accountable. It's not going after ghosts who are half a world away on another continent. It's going after big U.S. companies who are causing the harm. And that's important. These are people we actually can find. We can actually bring them to court and make them explain why they're doing what they're doing and ultimately make them stop. Two, this bill has a clear plan for enforcement. Namely, enforcement is by private parties under existing statutes pertaining to unfair competition, consumer protection. Other legislation sometimes places a big burden on the state itself to hire investigators and lawyers, I guess, to figure out the spyware purveyors are and to hold them accountable. Not so here. This is very sensible in asking private parties.
Before us, SB 137, evicting institutional property users. It's just scary to think about a title like that. But Mr. Michael
Shell.
Senator Zekin's staff is here to, Michelle, excuse me, him too is here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you, Chairperson Senator Bundy, for allowing me to testify. Like you said, SB 137, an act providing that an institution providing accommodations be exempt from certain provisions of the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. The University of Alaska asked that Senator Seekins carry this legislation. It stems from a few rare cases where disruptive students have used the court system to stall evictions from their unit until it was most convenient for them. These students' actions or infractions were way beyond what was allowed under their student housing contract. And because of their actions, the university needed to remove these students from their housing before their disruptive behavior started affecting other students in a more detrimental way. The Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act was designed to alleviate injustices inflicted on residential renters by unscrupulous private landlords. Though there are many variations from state to state, most of the provisions are basically the same. The state of Alaska's Landlord-Tenant Act is taken almost verbatim from the National Landlord-Tenant Act outlined in the Federal Fair Housing Act. This bill is meant to fix a discrepancy between the legislative intent of the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act and some recent lower court decisions regarding the eviction and removal of individuals residing in a residence that is owned by an institution described under AS 3403-330, which is a subsection of the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act, which begins in AS 3403. It reads, and this is in your packet, under Section B1, unless created to avoid the application of this chapter, the following arrangements are not governed by this chapter. Residents at an institution, public or private, if incidental to detention or provision of medical, geriatric, educational, counseling, religious, or other similar services. And it basically means public services, institutional entities such as hospitals, schools, counseling centers, or higher educational establishments are not compatible with the heightened protections that were designed under the Landlord-Tenant Act. These larger institutions are not in the business of long-term residential housing and have been exempted under statute for a reason. Examples of this would be a hospital shouldn't be required to obtain a court order to remove a patient who no longer needs its services. A student who is expelled from school shouldn't be able to insist on remaining inside student housing until a court order is obtained to remove the former student. Counseling agencies dealing with an individual who has problems shouldn't have to get a court order to evict or remove this disruptive patient after their course of treatment has been completed. The University of Alaska has put in place a three-strike system intending to work with students regarding their university housing. There's a review process for major infractions to give just due process to the students. There's even an appeal process. By no means has the university displayed an intent to evict students immediately, and has shown a dedication to working with students that are not observing student housing rules. That's about it. Thank you for the time. I'll entertain any questions. Otherwise, Mike Sprague, who is the Associate Vice President of Student Services at the UAF, he'd be best to answer any questions the committee may have. Otherwise, we also have Michael Hostina, who's an associate for the university's general counsel, and he's been dealing with some of the legal issues the university has had regarding students in their dorms.
Okay, thank you. Of course, clever students like that point out why we don't need a law school up here. We already have enough guardhouse lawyers. Okay, questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, let's go to Mr. Hostina on teleconference.
Thank you. This is Mike Sprague from the University of Alaska System. We would we thank you for entertaining the thoughts and the concerns that we have. I will tell you that it is the role and the mission of this institution to serve our students, and on the rare occasion that we have some students who make an environment for education not as productive as we might see, we do have processes in place that allow us to do a case-by-case review of issues. Is certainly, and as someone who is tasked by the President and the Board of Regents to make sure that our student services and our environment here for education is in place, it is certainly not the intent of any of us to make undue challenges to our students in terms of hurdles. In fact, we look to do things on a case-by-case basis, although within a framework, to address issues because we don't want to treat all students the same way in terms of a rule applying to a specific issue. We like looking at these on a case-by-case basis. Having said that, because we are exempt, it doesn't mean that we are required to look at processes internally. So we have those processes that were presented to you. These are internal processes, administrative guidelines that we follow. There is a review of any issue. That issue is reviewed on a case-by-case basis. If we find that it's in the best interest of the institution, our students, and a particular student, to ask them to leave residence. The student has the right in a due process procedure to appeal that to a dean of students. And then certainly the dean of students can make the final decision. And of course, if the student does not think that the final appeal decision, that they agree with the final decision, that they can certainly go to Superior Court for appeal as well. But I guess we would like to emphasize that this is an educational institution. These are not arbitrary dismissals of students. There is a process in place. We follow that process, and we have a responsibility to make sure that our environment is conducive to education while maintaining the processes in place and understanding that our role is to educate our students.
All right, thank you. I see no questions. Mr. Serfaga, would you like to testify?
Well, that was me. That was Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had called for Mr. Hostina, but...
I apologize.
Yeah. Mr. Sprague can speak better to the student side of the issues, and I'm here to answer any legal questions that you may have. Our concern is that we end up in a few cases with students really getting two bites of the apple. They follow the administrative procedure within the university. If they don't like that outcome, they then go to court to seek to block their removal from housing. we end up with multiple processes going on, and I think it was you, Mr. Chairman, who hit the nail right on the head. You know, we have some schoolhouse, we have had a couple of schoolhouse lawyers here on campus, and they've cost us literally, you know, tens of thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of administrative time to accomplish what everybody agrees, even the courts agree, should be a relatively simple process. But the courts have felt obligated to require an eviction action because of the language of the current forcible entry and detainer statute. So that in a nutshell, is the only thing I would add.
And you said a couple. How many students have been a problem like this?
In the time I've been in this office, the last 2 years, I can think of one only that has really cost us, that one student has literally cost us tens of thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of time. Mr. Sprague may, I believe, have other examples over his tenure, which is longer than mine in this office.
Okay, thank you. I see no further questions. Is there anyone else here in Juneau would like to testify in SB 137? Seeing none, we'll set this aside and bring it up again at your convenience. And that brings us to the ever-popular SB 130.
She's not here, Bob.
Oh, we have somebody to testify, but from the ad hoc committee is not here. Do we have anybody online that wanted to testify on 130? Okay, well, I'd like to continue with public testimony on Senate Bill 130. It's still a work in process, so we'd like to have input. And going to Anchorage, Jerry Flock, please.
Mr. Chairman, Jerry Flock is over at the House Labor and Commerce testifying, as is another person signed up. We do have another person that is here right now that would like to testify on this particular bill.
All right. I have Barb Williams.
She is the other person, and you should have gotten a revised participant list of a third participant, because Ms. Williams is over at the other Labor and Commerce.
Okay, and then who do you have there?
One more person, your name? Mr. Chairman, if you have other testifiers, I will get Ms. Williams.
Well, do you have a Vernadetta Rawls there?
She is here, but she needs assistance from Ms. Williams, so I will I will get Ms. Williams right at this time.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone here in Juneau that would like to testify on SB 130?
Let's just pass it out.
Mr. Chairman, we have Ms. Williams here right now.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead with your testimony, please. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Barbara Williams, and I'm with the Alaska Injured Workers Alliance, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today. My testimony is that the Alaska Injured Workers Alliance does not support these bills for a number of reasons. Medical costs, asking for a rollback of rates, will only lead to a bigger shortage of physicians available to treat injured workers. We're not only addressing we are also not addressing the problems of the fee schedule. According to Ingenix, the fee schedule holder, they have only sold approximately 2,000 fee schedules in the state of Alaska. When we added up the doctors and the potential fee schedule users, we came out with more than 3,000 people potentially using this fee schedule. Some of the health care providers that we surveyed, A, hold a fee schedule, and B, regularly have their bills reduced below the rate set out in the fee schedule. This would mean that globally, if insurance review companies are reducing payments, there is no clear idea of how much each company is saving on medical costs. What it does reveal to us is that the medical costs are already being cut. It also tells us that not only are insurance companies saving money, but they are providing little information on what those savings might be. We also have no enforcement of the current fee schedule. It would appear that there is more cost shifting here than enforcement of the current fee schedule. We need reliable data and information to address these costs. And I'm going to stop right there real quick to say that in this package I'm sending you all, I have collected in my survey different information from these audit review companies, from Providence Hospital and things like that, so that you can see yourself that these bills are being reduced and kind of what those costs are. Medical benefits. We do not believe that a preferred provider list or a drug list would be appropriate for workers' compensation. This further limits the care and drugs workers could potentially receive. Insurance companies now have control over what they're willing to pay for. The current law does not provide for pre-authorization of service, and pushing a list of providers and drugs would further complicate an already complex process. Equally, the injured employees would like to suggest the employers be held to an independent medical evaluator provider list. Injured workers would like to see only one doctor at a time unless a referral is provided. Right now, currently, injured workers are subject to panels of doctors paid for by employers. Adjudication of claims. We do not feel the proposed legislation would better serve injured workers or employers. There's currently no education process to explain to them how they should participate in the adjudication process. Complex changes as the proposed bill would, in our view, increase appeals, time delay appeals, to about the same time that we're currently looking at. Additionally, we do not feel that an overpanel should have the authority to set precedents over superior and supreme courts. The balance must be restored to the impartial process to create a fair chance for all parties. We're giving a lot of power to an unbalanced board or division, and we feel this is wrong. Retraining benefits. We feel that a clear retraining process that provides results for injured workers would be of greater benefit than the proposed bill. Injured workers know little or nothing about the retraining process, and this will add more red tape and confusion to an already complex part of benefits available to injured workers. Workers need to understand and not guess about what benefits they need. Overall, we know that the personnel in the division have little or no training on the complex hearing process, the Workers' Compensation Act, and little or no medical training, yet they must make complex decisions based on the information that is available to them. We need to encourage training for all staff, make benefits more clear, and base rate increases on tangible, factual data. We do not need to make sacrifices for the sake of expediency, but we do need to make informed changes based on facts. We have little or no information on the complex mess in medical costs, rehabilitation, retraining benefits, and know the hearings process is far from impartial. We don't want to jump into a series of changes to make the process more complex and harder than the last time. Legal counsel would not become more available unless defense costs are fully reported. Plaintiff attorneys are making approximately 50 cents on the dollar, while defense attorneys get dollar for dollar what they bill for. Why not drop the defense costs to match that of injured workers to contain costs? Insurance premiums should be frozen until we can figure out this mess so that employers are not overcharged for their insurance product. Hiring advocates in theory is good, but who wants the job? Legal Services is a nonprofit, and Alaska pro bono programs are not geared for workers' compensation. At minimum, it could potentially take up to 2 years for them to get the nuances of the program as well as the practices and procedures. We urge you not to pass this bill. The bill could create even a bigger mess than we currently have. Thank you. And like I said, in this testimony I have listed the people that we surveyed for the information on the health care providers. We have the contracts that doctors and physicians are being asked to sign to guarantee low payments. We have information in here where you can see what the bill charges are, what the reductions are, and how much money is being saved. And like in the Providence Hospital bill, they were billed for $14,000, and by delaying the bill and not utilizing the proper fee schedule, they reduced that bill over $3,000 and only paid out $11,000 dollars for the services that would have rendered them the $14,000. So I think that it's really clear that insurance companies are cutting costs, and even when some of these costs sit inside the fee schedule and are reasonable and customary, you know, I've got one here for, you know, where they bill $66. The fee schedule said they could bill up to $75, and the bill was reduced $10.35. And that doesn't sound like a lot. The $3,000 that Providence got their bill cut does sound like a lot. And if you accumulate all those write-offs and things that these different companies are taking because they can't get their fees, we would have a better idea of what the reductions of these medical costs would be. But there's no mechanism or oversight to report this to our workers' compensation division at this time.
We did have a question, Ms. Williams, about who is the who are the Alaska Injured Workers Alliance? You know, it's just a
the Alaska Injured Workers Alliance is a nonprofit organization educating injured workers, and we also are partners with ACPIRG because we also feel that there are consumer aspects to this when injured employees cannot get their insurance companies to pay. We help them file consumer complaints. We help them with employment issues, how to pursue benefits, filling out claim forms, and things like that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir, and have a nice day. And we will turn this into the people here so you can all have a copy.
Okay, we appreciate that. If you would, if you'd pass that down to us.
Thank you, sir, and have a nice day.
You as well. Is there anyone else in Anchorage you'd like to testify?
Chairman, we have Jerry Flock here at this time.
Okay.
My name is Jerry Flock, and I'm coming to you from the other side of the fence. The workers' comp laws that we have now, I have fallen through every possible crack in the system. The laws and how they read now, the people that are in charge won't even follow them. My employer was uninsured, and because my employer was uninsured, my employer got to pick what medical it would and would not pay for. We've had a problem with workers' comp for a while. We keep coming back here and repeating ourselves. There's an audit report all the way back from October 31 of 1999. About workers' comp and insufficiencies of workers' comp. This problem has been continuing for a while. What you have written here in Senate Bill 130 is just a Band-Aid to fix what's already broken. The law, as it, workers' comp law as it reads now, workers' comp already has police powers. They also have the exercise to police powers. Constitutionally, a Workers' Compensation Act is to be constitutional, must not be arbitrary, unreasonable, fundamental, unjust, or oppressive. The state of Alaska had to pay $10,000 for a surgery that I required because the employer would not pay their medical. The employer had an annual edit error for 1998. According to the law as it reads, if there is an annual edit error, there is a $10,000 fine and a $100 fine for every day up to it for 10 days afterwards. That means that this employer owes the state a total of $77,000. Will the state go for it? No, they don't go for it. They don't even ask for it. But yet the state will come after me for a $10,000 surgery that they paid for. There was officials in Juneau. I had a doctor in University of Washington call one of these officials in Juneau, and he asked the official, is the state of Alaska going to help this man, or is the state not going to help this man? This official stated that Mr. Flock is just the type of person to fall through the cracks of public assistance, workers' comp, and Social Security. If the lack of actions with the way the law is read now, and these people don't act on how these laws are already written, and you're going to go rewrite the law, how do we know that they're going to be followed? You know, my employer had allowed their insurance to lapse 18 times. According to the laws, that's against the law. That shouldn't happen. The state turned around and said, okay, Mr. Flock, the employer owes you $54,000. Here's a restitution judgment. Can they collect? No. Have I received anything? No. But yet... all the problems that you guys are having with the cost of medical, I've been trying to get medical for 7 years. And the only way that I was able to receive medical was when it came to the point of almost costing me my life. Judicially, this system is broken down not just in the workers' comp, it goes all the way to the judicial system. In the workers' comp law book, it reads that when the board considers it advisable, it may require an employer to make a deposit with the Department of Revenue to secure a prompt and convenient payment of compensation, and a payment for deposit and award shall be made by the order of the board. The board ordered my employer for a bond. The employer didn't pay for it, so the board said, okay, we're going to hold you contempt and take you to court. Under Statute 44560 or 590, it states that if an agency takes a person to court for contempt, the only question in front of that judge is whether that person should be held in contempt or not, not whether they can afford it. The judge turned around and asked my employer if she could afford it. She said, no, that was the end of case. And I'm still here today. If the system in which we are living now is broken or it's garbage, and all you're going to do is put a Band-Aid on it or try to fix it, you know, in old school, you took out the garbage and you started from over. You know, I don't know how to put my emphasis on where this is taking me today. Even in rewriting this bill, an example, in rewriting this bill, you guys turn around and say that if a representative on page 16... number E, if a representative of the Department of Investigations and if a representative of the department investigates an employer's failure to file the evidence of compliance required under Statute 2330.85, and after investigation there's substantial evidence that the employer failed to ensure the provide security as required under 2330.75, the representative shall inform the employer. The representative shall make a request to the director to issue the stop order prohibiting the issue of the use of employee labor until the employee ensures and provides security required as 2330.075. That's the same law that is already in place. It's been rewritten, and the only difference in this is the board may assess a penalty of $1,000 per day. An employer who is assessed under penalty under the subsection may not obtain a public contract with the state or political subdivision in the state for 3 years. My employer got a business license in 1991. In 1998, it was found that my employer had allowed their insurance to lapse 18 times. My employer has not been in compliance with the law since before 1991, and I'll be damned if this year the state still don't give my employer a license to do business in this state.
Well, there's a difference between a business license and enforcing a judgment, but your point is well taken. That I don't think any of us think that the current system is working well. And
okay, then what I would suggest, if you need a suggestion on how to fix it, why don't we go back to the drawing board, start over, and rewrite it? I mean, I understand I'm not no rocket scientist, and it ain't that easy. But you know, this rewording of it, how many ways can you reword the same thing, and the same people don't follow what you already got? What difference is it going to make?
Well, you're right. We need the enforcement, and that is one of the goals that we have in this committee. I thank you very much for your testimony. I want to go on now to Mr. Lozanki. I have a couple questions for him. Thank you. I'm very unlikely that you can comment on this specific case that Mr. Flock has been testifying on, but in general, the notion of enforcement, what tools do we have and how well are they being used to enforce our workers' comp laws, and particularly those who go bare. If someone came to you today with a complaint of someone who had dropped their insurance.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Paul F. Lasanke. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mr. Flock's case, I don't have all the specifics in front of me, Mr. Chairman, but it is fairly well known in the division. This was part of my testimony earlier to the committee about needing some kind of hammer to actually get on top of an uninsured employer quickly enough rather than coming in after the fact and trying to clean up the mess. I think Mr. Flock's testimony is very eloquent when it talks about how difficult it is to get anything once the problem has already transpired. I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Flock's statement that there isn't any change in this bill. He stopped reading right where I think the salient change kicks in, which is that the division director under this bill would be able to order a stop work order immediately, as opposed to what happens now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, where our investigator comes back, gets a hearing scheduled before the Workers' Compensation Board, and then there's a hearing to decide whether or not the employer is still uninsured at that moment. And that was part of my testimony earlier about I have no doubt that there are employers that do run without insurance for a period of time. And if they get detected, their normal response oftentimes is to bring their insurance current and go forward. And that can be a recurrent problem. And that would be something, that would be some of the factors that would be considered under this bill, if it were to pass, that the board could consider when deciding how much to fine that employer. And I think also based on Mr. Flock's testimony, which is eloquent as far as what happens when you get board orders and then you're trying to enforce them in the court system against somebody who may or may not have money. And I do not know anything about the specifics of the enforcement.
I'm guessing it's a rather compounding factor. You've got someone who's operating with marginal financing, so they drop their insurance because they don't have much money. And then there's an injury and there's a judgment, and how do you collect money from someone that doesn't have any money? I mean, that happens, I think, throughout our judicial system, where it's, well, I won't say easy, but it's one thing to get a judgment. It's a far different thing to be able to collect if someone is basically bankrupt. But it's your contention that by the change of allowing the director to immediately issue a stop work order, that we would have more enforcement opportunity than we currently have under the current system.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's my belief.
Other questions for Mr. Lasanke? Anyone else here that would like to testify on SB 130? I will continue taking public testimony on Thursday. And by a week from today, if there are amendments or suggestions from the committee, I would like to address a CS for the bill a week from today, and then see if we can move forward making our best attempt to not just put a Band-Aid on, but to revamp the system to make it more responsive to the injured worker and to do what we can to keep from driving businesses out of business so that workers don't have employment. So, we have nothing more to come before the committee. We will stand adjourned at 2:53.